This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking once again with Dr. Brenda Beck, who's adjunct professor in anthropology at the University of Toronto Scarborough campus. Brenda, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Raj.
Nice to see you once again. And for those who may have caught your last interview, you were talking about a fascinating story that has quite gripped you that you've continued working on since then. So the publication that we're going to focus on, although I think we'll just feature your work in general these days, we'll sort of take the temperature of where you're at and what you've been up to, but we will primarily focus on, for the purposes of the podcast, on a brand new publication called Hidden Paradigms, Comparing Epic Themes, Characters, and Plot Structures. So tell us a bit about the backstory of this book.
Well, the backstory began in 1964 when I went to do 2 years of doctoral fieldwork in what was at the time a fairly remote village in Tamil Nadu, South India. And we didn't have video cameras at that time, but I did take a tape recorder thinking that I might find something to tape record. I didn't really have a plan. And not very long after I got there around November, there was a full moon, I think it was January or February of 65. And I heard this marvelous drumming. And so I turned to the woman I lived with, my cook and companion, and I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Oh, come with me to the village square. I'll show you what's happening." So we went together, and there was two singers with a whole crowd of people around listening, and they were obviously telling a story. And my Tamil wasn't very good at the time, but I was trying. And so I thought, gosh, maybe this is an opportunity to use my tape recorder. And if I record the story, then later I can go back and I learn some Tamil by studying it, and I'll also learn the story. So I asked my companion to get the tape recorder. And meanwhile, I asked the two singers, "May I have permission to tape your story?" And they didn't really know what a tape recorder was, so I had to show them. And then they said, "Yes, that would be wonderful. We'd be delighted." And then they asked me, "What story would you like me to tell?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know your stories." And so I turned to the audience and I said, "What story would you like these two gentlemen to tell?" And they said, "The Anan Markadai, which means the elder brother's story." Well, I had no idea what the story was about. I thought maybe a 20-minute story, half an hour story. I was fine. I had enough tape. So the bard said yes, and they started to sing, not telling me anything about what to expect. And they went on for 2 hours. And then they said, "Well, that's enough for tonight. We'll come back and we'll continue the story tomorrow." And I thought, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? It was very difficult to get batteries at that time. And the village was still unelectrified, though they had run an electrical feed line down the road. And lo and behold, as you know, the gods were on my side, this man appeared and he said, "Hey, I can help. I can get you an illegal wire feed from this electrical line on the road." Of course, it was illegal, but nobody seemed to care. And I thought, what a blessing, because I don't have enough batteries to carry on. And thank goodness he did that, because it went on for about 18 nights. And every night they'd sing about 2 hours, and then they'd say, "We'd come back again." And I thought, my goodness, what a story. Turned out to be an epic. And I've worked on it ever since, which is now, what, almost 60 years. And it's become a treasure trove. I had no idea how enlightening and interesting and rich this story would be. And so I've continued. It's kind of like going on a treasure hunt. And I don't have a very good map, just a couple of hints. But every time I turn over a stone or look at something, I discover new ideas. And it's become very, very much a part of me, and also very useful for teaching. And so in writing The Hidden Paradigms, and also publishing now the full text of the story, I've created, I hope, a set of two books which can be used both in high school classrooms for literature teaching to show that there's, you know, interesting literature from other cultures beyond North America and Europe, if the teachers are teaching, you know, the classic epics of Europe. And then I thought, really, this is also going to be very useful at the university level for people who are either teaching about India, because it's so full of insights, you can use it as a foundation stone for teaching just about any aspect of Indian religious thinking, or to some extent, social thinking as well. So I want those who are listening to understand that it's very easy to access the text of the story and not just the analysis that I provide in Hidden Paradigms.
So many, many themes come to mind as I hear you speak. One is that we have so many advantages and conveniences that we take for granted, insofar as we can whip out our smartphone and capture a moment visually or in terms of audio, take a video. And back in those days, the tape recorder was high tech.
Absolutely.
And so it seemed that, as you say, the gods were on your side, and it was fortuitous that you took your tape recorder. What would have happened had you not had your tape recorder? That's incredible. And then,
I can answer that to some extent, because after I had the tape recording, I thought, gosh, this could be really important. I better not scrub the tapes and go back and forth, you know, trying to catch every word. And so I thought, maybe I could ask the lead singer to come and dictate the story. And my assistant, though he wasn't very highly educated, he was able to write. And I said, we'll get my assistant to write it down as he dictates it slowly. And he agreed to do that. And I paid him something to come. It took him a number of nights, of course, to dictate it. And he had to do it slowly because the scribe couldn't keep up with his speaking at the normal speed. So I actually have two versions of the story. The first one, which is tape recorded, is the performance version. And the second version is the dictated version. And it turned out that the dictated version is a lot easier to deal with, and it's better structured because the bard, you know, sat down and thought about it as he told it. And so I've used the dictated version for much of my study and analysis. But I should say that both versions are archived in several archives now, one at the American Institute of Indian Studies in Gurgaon, and then also at the University of Toronto and at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. So the originals are there. But the main point I want to make is I had a wonderful surprise just a few weeks back. A Tamil musician who's studying for a doctorate in the University of California has elected to go to Gurgaon and listen to the performance tapes in full and provide an analysis of the rhythms and the songs of the story. And I'm just delighted because I know that the rhythms of the songs were so important as I listened to the story. It was the songs that, to me, who couldn't understand everything that was being said, it brought the story to life. And from the songs, because you could feel the emotion in the songs. I could tell, you know, I could tell if it was a lullaby putting a baby to sleep, or if it was horses running. You could practically hear the hooves knocking against the stones in the song where the horses were running. And each song has that kind of quality. And I just yearn for someone who's musically far, far more knowledgeable than I am to be able to express and talk about how these two bards who worked together as a team, how they used rhythms. And they had just two very simple instruments, which were the classical instruments of a bard. One is a little hand drum that you just hold in one hand and you squeeze it to change the tone of the skin that you're tapping as you produce the sounds. And the other was a pair of finger, little brass finger cymbals that made a ting ting sound. That's all there was, but they used them brilliantly and they just provided a marvelous amount of emotion. This musician has this fellowship to do this work, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what he comes up with.
I can't resist asking this question, and then we'll dive into the book, but tell us a bit about the role of the bard, the function of the bard, whether they're trained, whether it's whether they ad lib, whether it's sort of, is it scripted? Do we know anything about that, the function in this context?
And it's all of the above. This is an oral story. It has never been written down in anything like the fullness that I have now provided. There were a few small palm leaf versions that have captured a little bit of the story that have been handed down from previous centuries. But it is basically, I would say, fully an oral tradition. But in India, because the tradition of memorizing is so strong, and the honor given to traditional stories is so great, these bards take it very seriously, and they study the story for years before they try to sing it themselves. And they apprentice to a senior bard who is like their guru, and they attend his performances and they become like helpers. So the two bards that sang, one was the lead, the guru, and the other one was an advanced student. And they played a very nice role. The assistant will say, "Oh, really? Tell me more. Oh, really?" And he'll repeat the lines or ask questions, and the bard will reply. So that also gives it a kind of a lively sense. And I would say, I think, though I don't really have evidence, the songs would be extremely well preserved, and they occur with the same lines and same epithets over and over in the story. The actual action and description of the story is a little less fixed in terms of words, but it's fixed in the bard's head in terms of the sequence and the descriptions. And I much later decided that I wanted to animate the story and tell it in animated form. The reason, what inspired me was, as the bard sang, they held up a oil kind of torch in front of the singers, because this is not an electrified village. And the singer sang against the white temple wall. And so there were these wonderful black shadows that the singers created, you know, without even thinking of them or being aware of it, behind them on the temple wall as they sang. And I used to watch those shadows because they were very expressive, and they helped me understand the story, because you could tell when, you know, things got tense and, you know, the shadows would express the concerns and the emotions. So I thought, gee, I want to share this story. It's marvelous. Let me see if I can animate it. And so I looked around, and I was extremely lucky. I found the grandson of one of these singers, who actually was a young animator. His father had wanted him to be an accountant because it was a poor family, but he hated accountant And he essentially ran away to Chennai and he said, I don't care what my father wants. I want to animate and tell stories. And just to make this really clear, when he was a small boy in the village where he lived, there was mud near the front door of his small home. And he used to pour water on that mud and mix it and make little clay figurines. And he would bake them in the sun. And then he would paint them with various colors. And then he would call all his friends and he would tell stories by moving his characters around on a small stage that he kind of envisioned in front of his house. So he was passionate about storytelling. And I managed to invite him to Canada. And I said, you know, I would love to have you come and help me animate the story. Of course, he didn't know English and it took some adjusting, but he did a wonderful job because he had sat on his grandfather's knee and heard this story over and over and over again. So it was already in his mind and all the images and, you know, background themes and values and so on were already there in his mind.
And so internalized.
Yes, internalized. And now, yes, believe it or not, he's used this as a, you know, to go further because he's always wanted to be an animator. And he's now working on, I think it's the third version of Avatar. He's in New Zealand at the company headquarters. He's become a very much, you know, in-demand animator. And I'm so proud to say that he started by working with me.
You know, irrespective of one's beliefs about this thing called life, it seems compelling to think that Destiny's hand is at work with you and your love affair with the story and the various levels of meaning this has for you and the connections that it has forged. So we will include a link in the podcast notes. There is a link in the podcast notes regarding how to procure the animation.
The University of Toronto has been very generous and they put the entire 13 hours of animation on their website and you can access it free of charge. You just
fantastic.
Have to know the right address to go to. And so for teachers, I highly recommend kind of using both the story as now printed and available as a text and using the animation because the animation gives you so much visual information. It's really helpful as a complement to the text. And also I should say from once we had the animation, just by good luck, I was advised that maybe we should do it in high def. Well, that was very cutting edge at the time, and I wasn't too sure, but I said, oh, well, okay, you know, what the hell, let's try. But because we did it in high def, you can freeze frames, and the frames are very, very clear. So I've used a great many of the frames in the story for my eventual writings and publications, including many in Hidden Paradigms, because they help illustrate the story. So that's also available in a graphic novel form where you can access the individual frames easily. And what the library's put up on the web is not high def because that's, you know, just too big, too many, at least at the time we put it up, it was too big. But if you need a high definition image for some reason or other, you can contact me and I'll be happy to supply it.
Fantastic. And just to clarify for the readers, in addition to those links available for the graphic novel, etc., in the podcast notes, there is a publication called Land of the Golden River. That is the publication wherein one can access the text in translation, whether for pleasure or for teaching. And the text that the publication that we're focusing on is Hidden Paradigms, which offers analysis. So tell us, Hidden Paradigms, why that title?
I guess I've always been interested in trying to understand how things are framed and what the background themes and principles are that inspire a story and are also, of course, what one discovers as one studies a story. And so I wanted to bring some of those hidden paradigms out And I'm still discovering them, Raja. Only in the last month or so, I've had a new idea about an even deeper paradigm that I need to write about soon. So this story is, it's like a cornucopia. It just keeps giving and giving.
It's the epic tale, sort of, you know, grand narratives. Yeah, I think all story on some level, but particularly, you know, mythological or epic stories, they're inexhaustibly rich, and that's not a bug, that's a feature. They're crafted in such a way so as to fold in multiple layers of meaning, and also in such a way that they can be applied in various contexts. I mean, that's the power of what I think of as mythological or epic storytelling. What is Hidden Paradigms arguing something? What would you say is the primary takeaway or argument of the book?
Well, let's frame that slightly differently. What motivated me was a frustration that people didn't seem very interested in the story or very proud of it. And many people told me, oh, it's just an oral story. And actually, I had difficulty when trying to publish the text because the publishers, many academic publishers told me, we publish great texts. We publish things that are really important. And this is some oral story from some village that's not worthy of us. So that gave me a passion to show that this is a story worthy of great respect and much study. And so I wanted to show that it could stand shoulder to shoulder with the greatest of epics and stories in the world. And so in Hidden Paradigms, I compare it to the Mahabharata, which of course is one of the great stories of the world. I compare it with the Bible, which also is one of the great stories of the world. But I also wanted to include other comparisons that might be compelling. And the most obvious one to me was the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the earliest recorded piece of epic literature in the world that we have access to. And lo and behold, the Epic of Gilgamesh and this story of the Golden River are very tightly connected. There's a lot of relationships between the two. And so I compare it with that and talk about the relationship to Mesopotamia. And it has given me a lot of insight into how the folk traditions in this one area of South India, I'm not sure if it is really, translatable into all of Tamil Nadu, but in this area, there's so many little details that reference ancient Mesopotamia, the Sumerian times in Mesopotamia. And so I try to bring that out in a couple of my later chapters. And in one of them, I compare the map of the stars, the constellations that were present in ancient Mesopotamian thought, at least according to one very creative author who's done a great job, Gavin White, of looking at the stars of ancient Mesopotamia. And lo and behold, there's a very interesting and informative match. The story does not match nearly as well with the nakshatras, which is the traditional Indian way of thinking about the stars, but it matches with ancient Mesopotamia. And in particular, a great wild boar is very important in the story. And he speaks, he has many human characteristics, but I knew early on that he must also be a constellation because there are some ancient rock carvings from central India that show a wild boar standing on its nose. Well, no live boar would ever stand on its nose. And so I knew right there, that's an image of the boar in the sky where you can see a boar standing on its nose. And that is an important feature of this star map of ancient Mesopotamia. And so from that, I thought, well, if the boar is there, then maybe some of the other characters are reflected there as well. And that also, of course, led me to look deeper into the story of Gilgamesh, which is a story from the same area and same era of early Mesopotamian history. So that's a theme that's developed, and which I hope as we get better archaeology and more information, we'll learn, I think, that there was a lot of contact between ancient Mesopotamia and the west coast of South India. Why? Because the Tamil and the Malayalam peoples were great sailors. They were traders, especially the Tamils. And so they had boats going back and forth with the major civilizational centers to the north very early on. And it's not hard to get back and forth if you follow the monsoon winds. Because at one time of year, you can basically float north with one monsoon season, and then you can float back the other way in the next season. So I don't think they walked over land for, you know, years to try to get there through the mud and the mountains and the jungles. I think they just floated down, and they had a major exchange going based on boat travel. And there's some recent DNA evidence that suggests that may be the case. We need to do more research and more specific DNA studies to expand on that idea. So that's one of the, I think, significant kind of insights I've had from studying this story.
Well, this is without question a fascinating, if not earth-shattering connection. I mean, so what you're positing is that the story is quite ancient.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's lots of evidence. And I said I had a recent kind of gestalt insight as well that has to do with the last, the most recent books of the Rig Veda. That's book one and book 10 are later than the other books. And I see in the description of the Asvin twins in those two books, 1 and 10, some very interesting parallels, not just that they're twins, as are the heroes in this story, but also they cure a woman who is infertile. And they do it very much as the heroine of the Golden River story is cured of her infertility. So I feel that there's, and there's some ritual connections and so on as well. So I think there's another dimension there to be explored in the future.
Is there other scholarship that conjectures a connection between ancient India and Mesopotamia?
Yes, there have been some suggestions, and of course the Derridian scholars in particular are interested in trying to show that Tamil, or at least some proto-Derridian language, was important very early on and maybe linked to the Sumerian language in ancient times. But that is a very politically a hot topic right now, and it's contested by many northern scholars. So we have yet to see. We haven't deciphered the Indus Valley script. It's one of the only early scripts in the world that has not been deciphered because there's no Rosetta Stone. So there's lots of debate as to whether it's Indo-European Sanskrit related language or possibly a Dravidian language. And there are people, well-known scholars arguing on both sides. I don't want to get into that hot topic right now.
We'll save that for another podcast.
Yes.
What changes would you like to see? Well, let me first say, you know, I typically don't interrupt guests, but if I did, I would have interrupted to say, you know, I can really relate to folks wanting to dismiss folk narratives because, you know, this is the history of the study of the Puranas. Although they have been written down and there is a textual tradition, it seems to me that, you know, one wonders whether or not the bardic traditions you've encountered may well shed light on the process of the composition of the Sanskrit Puranas themselves. But the idea, it's a staggeringly different idea to have a text that was composed for someone to look at independently versus writings that are the residue of an organic oral culture. Right. And so it's a staggeringly different idea. And many times in teaching, whether typically on retreats or the classes, depending if it's continuing studies, you know, I'll share stories. I'll tell stories, and then we'll interpret them. And every once in a while, someone is really keen on the reference for the story. Where can they go find the story? And depending on the type of teaching I'm doing, I'll say, look, the text is on the tongue. That is the story. You've just received the text. That was the text, right? Mm-hmm. And this is something that we have trouble really, particularly when we're trained, as we both are at the Western Academy. And obviously, you know, text is paramount without question. But it's really difficult, I think, to undo the internalization of the value system of, you know, it's important if it's written down. It's real if it's written down versus so much is preserved in oral culture. And also the other prejudice towards folk traditions is naive or superstitious or unthinking. And yeah. And yet there's such profound
inferior to
yes, the, but what is, but what it is that it, in my experience, looking at you know, the epics and Puranas and various other, you know, oral culture stories, these narratives do the heavy lifting of philosophy, theology, culture, propagation of ideas, but in an unassuming manner that's accessible to people. Yes, and yes. I think it seems, yeah, just so if I were in the habit of interrupting, I would have interrupted to chime in to say that perhaps.
Let me interrupt you to go back to your question about hidden paradigms, because to me, the kind of paradigm that I'm looking at is basically a visual paradigm. And I think the way these bards remember and learn the stories is through the scenes that they paint in their mind. And the story progresses from one scene to another with transition or movement between them. But the key elements, the key values, the key relationships are embedded in those scenes. And that's why I was so fortunate. And the work I did with this animator, whose name is Ravi Chandran, from South India, it has been so enriching for me because he has those scenes in his head. And I just gave him total freedom. You know, design and paint the story the way you see it. And that has been like a added text for me, just going back, and I continue to discover things in his animated version that tell me more about the story, things I've noticed now that I hadn't noticed 10 or 15 years ago.
You know, as I hear you speak about the sort of the visualization of the storyboard, if you will, what comes to mind is my first book, The Goddess and the King in Indian Myth. It's my dissertation. It's a study of the Devi Mahatmya, but really it's a study of the structure of the Devi Mahatmya, frame and all. And, you know, for about 150 years, folks have been saying, Western scholars have been saying, look, it's a flimsy frame. It was sort of stapled into the Markandeya Purana, sort of, you know, willy-nilly. And there's no shortage of places in which this revolutionary text could have been positioned, whether in the Mahabharata, whether in another Purana, there must be a reason why it's here. And in tracking the structure, it was discovered that it's structured as a ring composition, a very strong, meaningful ring composition. And we see ring compositions all over the ancient world. And it seems to me that, you know, the best conjecture I have at this point is that this was a tool for thinking about and remembering stories by visualizing.
Absolutely.
The ring of the story. This wasn't a, let's write it this way. I mean, perhaps it's meaningful to the audience as well, if unconsciously, perhaps more so than consciously, perhaps consciously for those who are really paying attention to structure, or perhaps just something that's enjoyable about this to us, this level of structure. But it seems to me that perhaps the ring composition exists in texts like the Devi Mahatmya as an aid to memorization.
That makes great sense to me. And I would also say, to me, you're using the word ring, R-I-N-G?
Correct.
So it's a circle, basically.
A chiasmus, yes. Yeah. So, for example, there are three parts, right? Or say there's five parts. There's A, B, and then a thing in the middle, and then B prime and A prime. So the first one and the fifth one will relate to each other. The second one and the fourth one will relate to each other. There's parallelism between them. And then there is a midpoint. Mary Douglas, you know, in my view, she wrote a monograph, I think, called Thinking in Circles, or something along those lines. In my view, she wrote that just so I could finish my dissertation properly. But anyhow, it's like she writes this work on ring composition, which is obviously, you know, Mary Douglas, clearly this is, you know, off the beaten track of what she's accustomed to doing, it seems. But so insightful. And I just had this instinct that the middle episode is so, so important in the text. It's crucial. It's the Mihisha Suramardini episode. It's the most iconographically celebrated moment of the goddess's career, when she, you know, she slays Mahisha, when, you know, all decked out, pinning him down, the buffalo demon. And this is the middle episode. And I'm like, this is really important. This is in the middle for on purpose. And then it dawned on me that, yes, this is center stage. And then what comes before mirrors what comes after. After what comes before that mirror what comes after, you know. And so I didn't have a language for it.
That makes great sense. And I think that we could write something about the Golden River story that would say the same thing. And particularly the idea of rebirth and the sequencing of generations. And each generation is a ring, if you like, that is the basic structure of the previous ring, but then something in the center of it is different. And I see the same thing with the Aspen twins, who become the heroes in this story. The theme of twins is repeated many times. It's also the theme of reflection, which I talk about quite a bit, that one character in this story, the key heroine of the farming community, is reflected in the key heroine of the forest. And so you have she's essentially twinned, and you have the contrast of the farm and the forest in the pairing of these two powerful women. So you could say, raising it up a bit, that the idea of the twins is repeated over and over in Indian stories. There are Nakula and Sahadeva in the Mahabharata, for example. And each time there's some change, they're fresh, they're new, but they still follow the basic ideas embedded in the very early themes of twinship, which go way back to Mitra and Varuna in the very earliest Indo-European traditions.
Fascinating. So who's this book for? Who do you think would benefit from Hidden Paradigms?
Well, I think the most important audience from my perspective are teachers who are teaching about epic traditions or Indian traditions, and to sort of provide comparative material, easily put that in their grasp, so they don't have to go and do a whole lot of background research. They have, you know, if they're going to give a class on this or that, they can just pull from the book and use it as a jumping off point for entering into the richness of this story. It also can be used by researchers, but I don't think that's going to be that useful a tool for researchers. It's more for teaching about Indian culture and traditions. And I should also say that the book that has the text, The Land of the Golden River, I worked with a very dedicated indexer who's developed a huge index, much bigger than the average index. And it has some very interesting features, because normally you don't index a story, you index an analysis, but not the story. But now we have a story that's indexed, so that any theme that you want to look up will hopefully be in the index, or you at least get a clue in the index as to where to find the related materials. And I'm hoping that the book will be used in that way by people who are researching any of a great number of themes, including the idea of a ring.
Fascinating. We're coming fairly close to time for today, but I wonder, I honestly get the sense that we can go on for 2 hours easily, but we want to keep it within within folks is we want to sort of be mindful of people's time who are listening. But is there anything else about the book that you wanted to add for those who might be interested in diving in?
I would add maybe two things. One is that the framework that I use for comparison is sort of unique. And that is, yes, here we go. There are seven themes that I actually picked up from working with a North American indigenous cycle of the story of Nanebush, a wonderful book written about Nanebush that uses these ideas. Roots, reclamation, resistance, resilience, relationships, reflection, and revelation. And I found that those are doors that can help somebody who's trying to get their feet on the ground and dealing with two stories that, in terms of superficial content, seem very different. But if you ask, what are the roots? Where? What's the beginning? What's the, you know, what's the cosmic foundation of the story? Or if you ask, for example, the idea of reclamation, how are people using this to reclaim their past, to understand their past, and so on for the other themes, that can be a very rich way of entering the story. So those seven themes are featured in every comparison. But the other thing I might say in terms of hidden paradigms, there are two paradigms that I discussed towards the end of the book that I feel are, they sound very superficial, but they actually, if you explore them, they're very, very enriching. One is the theme of the lotus. And it's significant that the key heroine in the story, her name is Tamarai, which means lotus. That's a clue to the importance of the lotus as a deep, deep symbol and theme. And the other one is rain. And initially when I read and listened to the story, I thought, oh, you know, rain, everybody has rain, it's nothing new, you know, I kind of didn't pay much attention to it. But as the years have passed and I've looked at the story in more depth, I realized that the idea of rain, which of course was related to the monsoon rains, is very, very important. And it's the beginning of the new cycle. It refreshes and everything bursts into new life because it's been dried up by the heat and the drought that precedes the monsoon. And so it is interesting that the key hero, the husband of the woman who's called Lotus, he is described as having this kind of rain in almost inside him. Everywhere he goes, he takes the rain and he makes it rain. So it's a kind of a blessing that he can give to people. He cools them, he refreshes them by granting rain. And so he is, in a sense, a carrier or a bestower of rain, which is, I think, a very central symbol related to, of course, refreshing and regrowing.
Fascinating. I think we'll have to continue chatting after we finish this podcast. It goes without saying that you've had a rich, productive career engaging this this profound story, this tale, this epic tale. So when I typically end with this question, but perhaps it'll be evident in your case. So is this work that you'll be continuing? You know, what's next for you?
Absolutely. I've got this new idea and I can't wait to start writing about it.
Fantastic. Well, when that gets churned out into the world, I know a guy who runs a podcast who would happily have you back on.
And I know who to go to.
Thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Raj. Thank you very much.
For those listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Brenda Beck on a couple new publications, primarily on Hidden Paradigms, which offers a fascinating analysis of this profound epic folktale. The tale itself can be found in Land of the Golden River. We will include a link in the podcast notes for that publication, along with all the other references made herein. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the importance and the power of folktales. Take care.